Chapter 8. As I shut the door of my lodging behind me and came out into the streets at 6 on a drizzling Saturday evening in the last past month of January, all that neighborhood of Covent Garden looked very desolate. It is so essentially a neighborhood which has seen better days, that bad weather affects it sooner than another place which has not come down in the world. In its present reduced condition it bears a thaw almost worse than any place I know. It gets so dreadfully low-spirited when damp breaks forth. Those wonderful houses about Drury Lane Theatre, which in the palmy days of theatres were prosperous and long-settled places of business, and which now change hands every week, but never change their character of being divided and subdivided on the ground floor into moldy dens of shops, where an orange and half a dozen nuts, or a pomatum pot, one cake of fancy soap, and a cigar box, are offered for sale and never sold, were most ruefully contemplated that evening by the statue of Shakespeare, with the raindrops coursing one another down its innocent nose. Those inscrutable pigeonhole offices, with nothing in them, not so much as an inkstand, but a model of a theater before the curtain, where, in the Italian opera season, tickets at reduced prices are kept on sale by nomadic gentlemen in smeary hats too tall for them, whom one occasionally seems to have seen on racecourses, not wholly unconnected with strips of cloth of various colors, and a rolling ball. Those Bedouin establishments, deserted by the tribe, and tenantless, except when sheltering in one corner an irregular row of ginger beer bottles, which would have made one shudder on such a night, but for its being plain that they had nothing in them, shrunk from the shrill cries of the newsboys at their exchange in the kennel of Catherine Street, like guilty things upon a fearful summons. At the pipe shop in Great Russell Street, the death's head pipes were like theatrical memento mori, admonishing beholders of the decline of the playhouse as an institution. I walked up Bow Street, disposed to be angry with the shops there that were letting out theatrical secrets by exhibiting to workaday humanity the stuff of which diadems and robes of kings are made. I noticed that some shops which had once been in the dramatic line, and had struggled out of it, were not getting on prosperously like some actors I have known, who took to business and failed to make it answer. In a word, those streets looked so dull, and, considered as theatrical streets, so broken and bankrupt, that the found dead on the blackboard at the police station might have announced the decease of the drama, and the pools of water outside the fire engine makers at the corner of Long Acre might have been occasioned by his having brought out the whole of his stock to play upon its last smoldering ashes. And yet, on such a night in so degenerate a time, the object of my journey was theatrical. And yet within half an hour I was in an immense theater, capable of holding nearly 5,000 people. What theater? Her Majesty's? Far better. Royal Italian Opera? Far better. Infinitely superior to the latter for hearing in, infinitely superior to both for seeing in. To every part of this theater, spacious fireproof ways of ingress and egress. For every part of it, convenient places of refreshment and retiring rooms. Everything to eat and drink carefully supervised as to quality, and sold at an appointed price. Respectable female attendants ready for the commonest women in the audience. A general air of consideration, decorum, and supervision, most commendable. An unquestionably humanizing influence in all the social arrangements of the place. Surely a dear theater, then? Because there were in London, not very long ago, theaters with entrance prices up to half a guinea a head, whose arrangements were not half so civilized. Surely, therefore, a dear theater? Not very dear. A gallery at 3 pence, another gallery at 4 pence, a pit at 6 pence, boxes and pit stalls at 1 shilling, and a few private boxes at 0.5 crown. My uncommercial curiosity induced me to go into every nook of this great place, and among every class of the audience assembled in it amounting that evening, as I calculated, to about 2,000 odd hundreds, magnificently lighted by a firmament of sparkling chandeliers. The building was ventilated to perfection. My sense of smell, without being particularly delicate, has been so offended in some of the commoner places of public resort, that I have often been obliged to leave them, when I have made an uncommercial journey expressly to look on. The air of this theater was fresh, cool, and wholesome. To help towards this end, very sensible precautions had been used, ingeniously combining the experience of hospitals and railway stations. Asphalt pavements substituted for wooden floors, honest bare walls of glazed brick and tile even at the back of the boxes for plaster and paper, no benches stuffed, and no carpeting or baize used. A cool material with a light glazed surface, being the covering of the seats. These various contrivances are as well considered in the place in question, as if it were a fever hospital. The result is, that it is sweet and healthful. It has been constructed from the ground to the roof, with a careful reference to sight, and sound in every corner. The result is, that its form is beautiful, and that the appearance of the audience, as seen from the proscenium with every face in it commanding the stage, and the whole so admirably raked and turned to that center, that a hand can scarcely move in the great assemblage without the movement, being seen from thence is highly remarkable in its union of vastness with compactness. The stage itself, and all its appurtenances of machinery, cellarage, height and breadth, are on a scale more like the Scala at Milan, or the San Carlo at Naples, or the Grand Opera at Paris, than any notion a stranger would be likely to form of the Britannia Theatre at Hoxton, a mile north of St. Luke's Hospital in the Old Street Road, London. The 40 thieves might be played here, and every thief ride his real horse, and the disguised captain bring in his oil jars on a train of real camels, and nobody be put out of the way. This really extraordinary place is the achievement of one man's enterprise, and was erected on the ruins of an inconvenient old building in less than 5 months, at a round cost of £25,000. To dismiss this part of my subject, and still to render to the proprietor the credit that is strictly his due, I must add, that his sense of the responsibility upon him to make the best of his audience, and to do his best for them, is a highly agreeable sign of these times. As the spectators at this theater, for a reason I will presently show, were the object of my journey, I entered on the play of the night as one of the 2,000 and odd hundreds, by looking about me at my neighbors. We were a motley assemblage of people, and we had a good many boys and young men among us. We had also many girls and young women. To represent, however, that we did not include a very great number, and a very fair proportion of family groups, would be to make a gross misstatement. Such groups were to be seen in all parts of the house. In the boxes and stalls particularly, they were composed of persons of very decent appearance, who had many children with them. Among our dresses there were most kinds of shabby and greasy ware, and much fustian and corduroy that was neither sound nor fragrant. The caps of our young men were mostly of a limp character, and we who wore them, slouched, high-shouldered, into our places with our hands in our pockets, and occasionally twisted our cravats about our necks like eels, and occasionally tied them down our breasts like links of sausages, and occasionally had a screw in our hair over each cheekbone with a slight thief flavor in it. Besides prowlers and idlers, we were mechanics, dock laborers, costermongers, petty tradesmen, small clerks, milliners, stay makers, shoe binders, slop workers, poor workers in 100 highways and byways. Many of us on the whole, the majority were not at all clean, and not at all choice in our lives or conversation. But we had all come together in a place, where our convenience was well consulted, and where we were well looked after, to enjoy an evening's entertainment in common. We were not going, to lose any part of what we had paid for through anybody's caprice, and as a community we had a character to lose. So, we were closely attentive, and kept excellent order, and let the manor boy who did otherwise instantly get out from this place, or we would put him out with the greatest expedition. We began at 6:30 with a pantomime so long, that before it was over I felt as if I had been traveling for 6 weeks going to India, say, by the overland mail. The Spirit of Liberty was the principal personage in the introduction, and the four quarters of the world came out of the globe, glittering, and discoursed with the Spirit, who sang charmingly. We were delighted to understand that there was no liberty anywhere but among ourselves, and we highly applauded the agreeable fact. In an allegorical way, which did as well as any other way, we and the Spirit of Liberty got into a kingdom of needles and pins, and found them at war with a potentate who called into his aid their old archenemy Rust, and who would have got the better of them, if the Spirit of Liberty had not in the nick of time transformed the leaders into Clown, Pantaloon, Harlequin, Columban, Harlequina, and a whole family of sprites, consisting of a remarkably stout father and three spineless sons. We all knew what was coming, when the Spirit of Liberty addressed the king with a big face, and his majesty back to the side scenes, and began untying himself behind, with his big face all on one side. Our excitement at that crisis was great, and our delight unbounded. After this era in our existence, we went through all the incidents of a pantomime. It was not by any means a savage pantomime, in the way of burning or boiling people, or throwing them out of window, or cutting them up, was often very droll, was always liberally got up, and cleverly presented. I noticed that the people who kept the shops, and who represented the passengers in the thoroughfares, and so forth, had no conventionality in them, but were unusually like the real thing, from which I infer that you may take that audience in if you wish to, concerning knights and ladies, fairies, angels, or such like, but they are not to be done as to anything in the streets. I noticed, also, that when two young men, dressed in exact imitation of the eel and sausage cravated portion of the audience, were chased by policemen, and, finding themselves in danger of being caught, dropped so suddenly as to oblige the policemen to tumble over them, there was great rejoicing among the caps, as though it were a delicate reference to something they had heard of before. The pantomime was succeeded by a melodrama. Throughout the evening I was pleased to observe virtue quite as triumphant as she usually is out of doors, and indeed I thought rather more so. We all agreed, for the time, that honesty was the best policy, and we were as hard as iron upon vice, and we wouldn't hear of villainy getting on in the world, no, not on any consideration whatever. Between the pieces, we almost all of us went out and refreshed. Many of us went the length of drinking beer at the bar of the neighboring public house, some of us drank spirits. Crowds of us had sandwiches and ginger beer at the refreshment bars established for us in the theater. The sandwich as substantial as was consistent with portability, and as cheap as possible, we hailed as one of our greatest institutions. It forced its way among us at all stages of the entertainment, and we were always delighted to see it. Its adaptability to the varying moods of our nature was surprising. We could never weep so comfortably as when our tears fell on our sandwich. We could never laugh so heartily as when we choked with sandwich. Virtue never looked so beautiful or vice so deformed as when we paused, sandwich in hand, to consider what would come of that resolution of wickedness in boots, to sever innocence in flowered chintz from honest industry in striped stockings. When the curtain fell for the night, we still fell back upon sandwich, to help us through the rain and mire, and home to bed. This, as I have mentioned, was Saturday night. Being Saturday night, I had accomplished but the half of my uncommercial journey, 4. Its object was to compare the play on Saturday evening with the preaching in the same theater on Sunday evening. Therefore, at the same hour of 6:30 on the similarly damp and muddy Sunday evening, I returned to this theater. I drove up to the entrance, fearful of being late, or I should have come on foot, and found myself in a large crowd of people who, I am happy to state, were put into excellent spirits by my arrival. Having nothing to look at but the mud and the closed doors, they looked at me, and highly enjoyed the comic spectacle. My modesty inducing me to draw off some hundreds of yards into a dark corner, they at once forgot me, and applied themselves to their former occupation of looking at the mud and looking in at the closed doors, which, being of grated ironwork, allowed the lighted passage within to be seen. They were chiefly people of respectable appearance, odd and impulsive as most crowds are, and making a joke of being there as most crowds do. In the dark corner I might have sat a long while, but that a very obliging passerby informed me that the theater was already full, and that the people whom I saw in the street were all shut out for want of room. After that, I lost no time in worming myself into the building, and creeping to a place in a proscenium box that had been kept for me. There must have been full 4,000 people present. Carefully estimating the pit alone, I could bring it out as holding little less than 1,400. Every part of the house was well filled, and I had not found it easy to make my way along the back of the boxes to where I sat. The chandeliers in the ceiling were lighted. There was no light on the stage. The orchestra was empty. The green curtain was down, and, packed pretty closely on chairs on the small space of stage before it, were some 30 gentlemen, and 2 or 3 ladies. In the center of these, in a desk or pulpit covered with red baize, was the presiding minister. The kind of rostrum he occupied will be very well understood if I liken it to a boarded up fireplace turned towards the audience, with a gentleman in a black surtout standing in the stove and leaning forward over the mantelpiece. A portion of scripture was being read when I went in. It was followed by a discourse, to which the congregation listened with most exemplary attention, and uninterrupted silence and decorum. My own attention comprehended both the auditory and the speaker, and shall turn to both in this recalling of the scene, exactly as it did at the time. A very difficult thing, I thought, when the discourse began, to speak appropriately to so large an audience, and to speak with tact. Without it, better not to speak at all. Infinitely better to read the New Testament well, and to let that speak. In this congregation there is indubitably one pulse, but I doubt if any power short of genius can touch it as one, and make it answer as one. I could not possibly say to myself as the discourse proceeded that the minister was a good speaker. I could not possibly say to myself that he expressed an understanding of the general mind and character of his audience. There was a supposititious working man introduced into the homily, to make supposititious objections to our Christian religion, and be reasoned down, who was not only a very disagreeable person, but remarkably unlike life, very much more unlike it than anything I had seen in the pantomime. The native independence of character this artisan was supposed to possess was represented by a suggestion of a dialect that I certainly never heard in my uncommercial travels, and with a coarse swing of voice and manner anything but agreeable to his feelings, I should conceive, considered in the light of a portrait, and as far away from the fact as a Chinese Tartar. There was a model pauper introduced in like manner, who appeared to me to be the most intolerably arrogant pauper ever relieved, and to show himself in absolute want and dire necessity of a course of stone yard. For, how did this pauper testify to his having received the gospel of humility? A gentleman met him in the workhouse, and said, which I myself really thought good-natured of him, "Ah, John, I am sorry to see you here. I am sorry to see you so poor." "Poor, sir? Apostrophe replied that man, drawing himself up, I am the son of a prince. My father is the king of kings. My father is the lord of lords. My father is the ruler of all the princes of the earth. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and see, and this was what all the preacher's fellow sinners might come to, if they would embrace this blessed book, which I must say it did some violence to my own feelings of reverence, to see held out at arm's length at frequent intervals and soundingly slapped, like a slow lot at a sale. Now, could I help asking myself the question, whether the mechanic before me, who must detect the preacher as being wrong about the visible manner of himself and the like of himself, and about such a noisy lip server as that pauper, might. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.